And let's go ahead and pray. Lord, thank you for your goodness and your faithfulness. And we thank you, Father, for your word, and pray that you would grant to us wisdom and understanding about it and about what the future will be, the future that you have revealed to us. Give to us faith to believe it and minds to grasp it. Help us to understand, Father, the significance of it, because our futures are tied up in it. And so we ask for your help this morning in Jesus' name. Amen. So we're back to the book of Isaiah this morning. Isaiah chapter 9 is where we'll begin. We're talking about the kingdom, which is a dominant, if not the dominant, theme of the Bible narrative that begins in Genesis and reaches the consummation in the book of Revelation. And so broadly speaking, and you know, I'm just going to speak in great generalities that no doubt would offend adherence to both positions, but among those who are, who believe, right? I mean, they would count themselves genuine and faithful believers. There tend to be three major dominant strains of thinking about the kingdom, future events. We tend to know them with some derivative of the word millennial. So there is, first of all, amillennialism, which is no literal millennial kingdom of any sort, which is really the classic default position of the reformers. If you go back and read Reformed theology, and of course Reformed theology comes out of the Protestant Reformation, Lutherans would, for the most part, I think officially, denominationally, would be amillennial in their viewpoint. And so, again, I'm putting my words into their mouth. When you read about things like the millennium or the kingdom and those things, they view those as... And they, not in any disrespectful way, but they just would argue that God is talking to us in rather poetic, descriptive language about, you know, the ongoing struggle between God and Satan that will ultimately, of course, come to a conclusion with the victory of Christ and the eternal state. And then really more of an offshoot of amillennial, the amillennial position, is the postmillennial position, which again is a position held primarily by those in the Reform tradition, and not always to the never to the satisfaction of the pure amillennialists, who would view postmillennialism as a corruption of their doctrine. But a postmillennialist would not necessarily be hard and fast on the concept of 1,000 years, but he would be hard and fast on the return of Christ to earth to inaugurate, or not to inaugurate, actually in postmillennialism, to receive the kingdom. Right? The Bible talks about Christ receiving a kingdom, and postmillennial theology is that the gospel will triumph eventually, and that the world will be mostly converted to Christianity, and that Christ will come and receive then a kingdom that is already in some measure ready for a king and worthy of his dominion. And then there would be the position that I would hold, that churches like ours tend to hold, and you know, as always, you can't speak for everybody, but I will probably speak in the, you know, saying we, would be a traditional millennial position, that there will be a literal thousand-year reign that will come not when we have prepared it for Christ, but he will come at the end of the tribulation, and he will establish the kingdom and he will set it up. So everybody agrees, by the way. I mean, even amillennial, even postmillennial people, not so much postmillennial, but certainly amillennial people would agree that if you just take all of the texts literally, that you're going to end up with a premillennial kind of position and a clear 1,000-year reign. And we would argue, of course, that that is exactly what should happen, that we should take those texts literally, that God knows his own mind and he is able to communicate with us, you know, pretty accurately. We haven't really gotten into this yet, but we're going to have to at some point in time, because if we take all those verses literally and we go, there's going to be a literal kingdom and Jesus is really going to reign and all of those predictions are to be taken at face value, then we have to have some accounting of and explanation of what it means and how this is going to work to return in some substantial way. And we might get to that this morning is one of the reasons I'm kind of starting here. I don't know how far we're actually going to get because we didn't get all the way through last week's material. And so I don't know that coupling them up will get. But to go back to what I was saying, if we do take all those literally, and I do take them literally, and I would teach them literally, then that requires us to have some cogent explanation for what it means to have a temple during that time and a priesthood during that time and a ministry of the priesthood during that time. Because one of the things we really do not enjoy, folks, is the liberty to take parts of the Bible that we like and can explain literally and then to take those that we can't really explain or that don't seem to fit and go, well, those aren't literal. So we need to be consistent and as accurate as we can be. And this is one of the problems when we talk about our position. We go, look, you just got to take these things literally. God means 1,000 years. And then people are going to legitimately come back and go, really? So you think there's going to be Old Testament animal sacrifices again? And so we'll have to address that has to become a part of the discussion and the conversation. But we're not to that point yet, but it is a point. And it is certainly touched on in the book of Isaiah, and it is certainly touched on in the book of Jeremiah. So Isaiah chapter 9, however, is where we are this morning, right? Isaiah has been chronicling the failure of the covenant people, and he has been dealing with that in conjunction with the promise of a future reversal of that. We spent a fair amount of time talking about the dilemma that is posed by answering whether those are literal promises or spiritualized promises. And again, I would just simply argue that if the promises for the destruction of Israel are to be taken literally, then it seems that the promises for the restoration of Israel should be taken literally. And again, particularly within the framework of postmillennialism, they would argue they are taken literally, but they're transferred to the church. And so their literal fulfillment is found in the church. So we will get to that. All right, Isaiah chapter 9. All right, because we're talking about the kingdom, and if you want, this is really is not difficult to us because it's Bible, but it's way more than Bible. You know, we understand it even politically and historically. If you're going to have a monarchy, right? If you're going to have a monarchy, then you have to have a monarch. There has to be a king or a queen, and there has to be a realm. They have to be the king or the queen of something, and there has to be some aspect and dimension to their rule. You know, there's their rule means something. It is lived out in a variety of ways. And so, so when we talk about a biblical kingdom, we're talking about the same kind of thing. We're talking about a ruler. And that is, among believers, never debated for a moment. All right, everybody recognizes the kingship of Jesus Christ. That involves a realm, and there's disagreement there. Is this literally a geographical realm that we're talking about, or is it just simply the realm of our hearts that we're talking about? And there is a rule. There is something, right? Christ wields his authority over us in very concrete and substantial ways. I mean, his kingdom means something. And, you know, biblically, right, there are people that are for a variety, well, not for a variety of reasons, but a variety of descriptions of their rebellion are excluded from the kingdom. And we find that concept, and it's part of the New Testament letters. These kinds of people will not inherit the kingdom. And you get into the book of Revelation, and these kinds of people are excluded from outside of the realm and the entrance of the kingdom. So we have those dimensions. So in Isaiah chapter 9, verses 6 and 7, we have, of course, the Isaiah's introduction or description of the king. For unto us, verse 6, a child is born, unto us a son is given, the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end, upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it, to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. So, and the right? So, and again, we kind of know by default, we know by our Christian experience and our years of exposure to the Bible that this is a prediction about Jesus Christ the King. But let me ask you, if you would, to back up to Isaiah chapter 9, or to verse number 1 of Isaiah chapter 9 for just a moment. Right? To help put a little bit of this in context. Nevertheless, the dimness shall not be such as was in her vexation, when at the first he lightly afflicted the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and afterward did more grievously afflict her by the way of the sea beyond Jordan in Galilee of the nations, or Galilee of the Gentiles. The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. They that dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them hath the light shined. Thou hast multiplied the nation, not increased the joy. They joy before thee according to the joy in harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For thou hast broken the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, as in the day of Midian. For every battle of the warrior is with confused noise, and garments rolled in blood. But this shall be burning, shall be with burning and fuel of fire. Because, how will this be? Because unto us a child is born. Now the first part of Isaiah is quoted with reference to the ministry of Jesus Christ in Matthew 4, 13 through 17. This is a prediction of, right? We talked about this quite a bit when we talked about the Gospel of Mark. Jesus lived much of his earthly life and conducted much of his earthly ministry in Galilee, in the northern part of the nation of Israel. And on the other side of the Sea of Galilee is Galilee of the nations, Galilee of the Gentiles. And Christ had a ministry there. He preached the Sermon in the Mount, all right? He preached that, no doubt, both places. He performed miracles of multiplying loaves and fishes, some in Jewish territory, some in Gentile territory. This is a fulfillment, and it's an anticipation of the kind of ministry that Christ is going to have. So we are introduced to the king. This king, of course, is a son, Isaiah 9:6. This king is God, right? He is called the Mighty God, and we have all these descriptions about him. What are his names? Wonderful. And it's not Wonderful Counselor, because wonderful is a noun and counselor is also a noun. So it's not the kind of counselor that he is. What kind of counselor is he? He's a great counselor. His name is Wonderful. His name is Counselor. He is the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. And so he is a son, he is God, he is the Governor of Peace. Right, we talk about what is the reign of Christ like? It is like peace. This is what it will be like. And frequently these kinds of descriptions are given to the reign. Right? There won't be weapons of war. Right? Second Amendment guys, and I am a Second Amendment guy. But the Second Amendment is pretty clear. We're gonna melt down our assault weapons and turn them into farm implements. And we will do this gladly and joyfully because our King's reign is a reign of peace. And when the time returns, by the way, that there has to be war, he's got all the weapon of war that he needs at his disposal. He doesn't need our guns. So, and this king, jumping ahead in the book of Isaiah, this king in chapter 11, this king will transform the world. Isaiah chapter 11, verse number 1. There shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his root. And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord, and shall make him of quick understanding in the fear of the Lord, and he shall not judge after the sight of his eyes, neither reprove after the hearing of his ears. But with righteousness shall he judge the poor, and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall slay the wicked. And righteousness shall be the girdle of his loins, and faithfulness the girdle of his reins. So, and just we're just going to stop there. So there's a king predicted, unto us a child is born, and he's going to be the Mighty God, the Eternal Father, the Prince of Peace. And he is going to be a descendant of Jesse. And his early appearance is going to be relatively insignificant. Not to us, but when Jesus walked the earth and identified himself as the King of the Jews, nobody, not even his most devoted followers, could see him as a figure who was going to transform the world. But this is the prediction. And he will, folks, right? Verse number 4, he is going to have a worldwide ministry. Not just a ministry to the nation of Israel. And he is going to, in verses 6 and 7, he is going to recover lost Eden. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the kid, the calf and the young lion, the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. And the cow and the bear shall feed, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox, and the sucking child shall play on the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the cockatrice den. And so we see, right, and that's just verse number 9, they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Now, this is not just simply a transformation of the earth. It is a recovery of an Eden-like existence. Right? Carnivores will be returned to herbivores. That will be the nature of the world. So, and there will be then, in conjunction with that, verse number 10, there will be a restoration of the nation of Israel. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign to the people. To it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria and from Egypt and from Pathros and from Cush and from Elam and from Shinar and from Hamath and from the islands of the sea. And he shall set up an ensign for the nations and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. And again, we tend to know that. And I just want, because I really do not want to be very disrespectful, that's not my intention, but traditionally people like us folks, we read those verses and we go, look, see, 1948, Israel was recovered. The restoration of Israel in 1948 could not possibly be the restoration that is being discussed here in the Bible. And we don't, that doesn't emerge in this chapter, in Isaiah chapter 11, but it does emerge in other chapters. There are going to be components of the regathering of Israel that have yet to be accomplished. Right? I mean, we're glad for the recovery of Israel. We're glad for their national identity. There are lots of reasons for us as Gentile believers to anticipate that and to look forward to it, folks. But what we have right now is we have 7 million Jewish people living in their native homeland, the vast majority of whom identify as atheists. They are not looking to Jesus as their deliverer. And biblically, that must happen. That must happen for there to be the kind of kingdom that the Bible describes. They must embrace their Messiah. So, this king will transform the world. This is what is anticipated. And let's jump ahead to Isaiah chapter 19. Gentiles are a part of that kingdom. Isaiah 19, verse number 16. In that day shall Egypt be like unto women, and it shall be afraid and fear because of the shaking of the hand of the Lord of hosts, which he shaketh over it. And the land of Judah shall be a terror unto Egypt. Everyone that maketh mention thereof shall be afraid in himself because of the counsel of the Lord of hosts, which he hath determined against it. In that day shall five cities in the land of Egypt speak the language of Canaan and swear to the Lord of hosts. One shall be called the city of destruction. In that day there shall be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord. And it shall be for a sign and for a witness unto the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt, for they shall cry unto the Lord because of the oppressors, and he shall send them a Savior and a great one, and he shall deliver them. And the Lord shall be known to Egypt, and the Egyptians shall know the Lord in that day, and shall do sacrifice and oblation. Yea, they shall vow a vow unto the Lord and perform it. And the Lord shall smite Egypt, he shall smite and heal it. And they shall return even to the Lord, and he shall be entreated of them and shall heal them. So there's a distinct prediction. Again, we ask the question, is it really Egypt? Should we anticipate this to be fulfilled literally? And we would argue, yes, down to verse number 24. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria. All right, so there's going to be a three kind of nation alliance. In that day shall Israel be third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land. Even a blessing in the midst of the land. Have you ever heard anybody talk about what a blessing Egypt is? We've been to Egypt. Blessed is not one of the words we would have used to describe it. Assyria? Anybody ever talked about the blessing of the Assyrians? This is the prediction, folks. Back to verse number 25, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. Now, again, and I mean no disrespect. I disagree, but I mean no disrespect. You could argue that that fulfillment exists in the church. But you're going to need to account then for the mechanism, right? You're going to have to provide the substantiation and the argument whereby God goes, well, when I was talking about Egypt and Assyria and Israel, I was just generically referring to Gentiles who would enjoy my blessing. So, again, when I develop the arguments literally, there are questions that are hard to answer. There are some questions that cannot be answered. When we turn it into the church, or we just back even farther away from that and just go, this is generally the way things are going to go, that God is going to do a great work among the Gentiles. There's going to be good. There's going to be bad. There's going to be peace. There's going to be difficulty. This is what the kingdom is like because we're in the kingdom right now. Then again, you have to, right? You have challenges to answer. You have questions to answer. And of course, we answer them to our own satisfaction, which is why we believe the things that we believe. And again, I'm not trying to be critical in that. I'm just saying that that's really how we all end up. It is not possible for all of us to have the Lord's mind on these things, folks. It just doesn't seem to me to be any way for it to be a literal kingdom that is not a literal kingdom unless it is fulfilled in the church, and it's not a literal kingdom or fulfilled in the church. It's just a description of good and bad and the way the kingdom is going to work. It's not possible, it seems to me, for all of them to be true simultaneously. So maybe it's me, but somebody here doesn't have the mind of the Lord on this. Back to Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 24. All right, so I would look at like Isaiah 19, or 19, 24, and 25, and I would argue that God is talking about distinct nations. And if you go, well, there is no distinct nation of Assyria today. You know, one of the things you learn about history is that nations come and go. And to us, there's no Assyria. To those who are the inhabitants of that territory and that land, some of those ancient identifications and boundaries, they don't recognize, or they only recognize under great duress. So who knows how that will go. Isaiah chapter 24, worldwide destruction will be followed by worldwide restoration. These are some of the things that Isaiah is predicting. Okay, let's look at Isaiah and 24, and I just want to read verses 1 through 6. Most of the chapter deals with this. But notice what Isaiah says here. Behold, the Lord maketh the earth empty, and maketh it waste, and turneth it upside down, and scattereth abroad the inhabitants thereof. And it shall be as with people, so with the priest, as with the servant, so with his master, as with the maid, so with her mistress, as with the buyer, so with the seller, as with the lender, so with the borrower, as with the taker of usury, so with the giver of usury. In other words, folks, there will be no exceptions to this, no exemptions, no class of people will be immune to what is being described in verse number 1, that the Lord is going to turn the world upside down. Verse number 3, the land shall be utterly emptied and utterly spoiled, for the Lord has spoken this word. The earth mourneth and fadeth away, the world languisheth and fadeth away, the haughty people of the earth do languish. The earth also is defiled under the inhabitants thereof, because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore hath the curse devoured the earth, and they that dwell therein are desolate. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men left. So we see a prediction of worldwide catastrophic devastation. Chapter 25, verses 1 through 5, what would be the purpose of this? What would be the purpose of God doing something like this? O Lord, thou art my God, I will exalt thee, I will praise thy name, for thou hast done wonderful things. Thy counsels of old are faithfulness and truth. For thou hast made of a city an heap, of a defense city a ruin, a palace of strangers to be no city, and it shall never be built. Therefore shall the strong people glorify thee. The city of the terrible nations shall fear thee. For thou hast been a strength to the poor, a strength to the needy in his distress, a refuge from the storm, a shadow from the heat, when the blast of the terrible ones is as a storm against the wall. Thou shalt bring down the noise of strangers as the heat in a dry place, even the heat with the shadow of a cloud, the branch of the terrible one shall be brought low. So we ask, why would God do something like this? And very quickly, the answer, very simply, the answer is, God will do these things for his own glory or for his own credit, to magnify his own name and his own abilities. God has an agenda, and the agenda is, right? The agenda is unchanged and ongoing in the world to this day. And then in verse number 6 of chapter 25, there is yet a change. And in this mountain shall the Lord of hosts make unto all people a feast of fat things, a feast of wine on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of wines on the lees and refined. And he will destroy in this mountain the face of the covering cast over all the people, and the veil that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death in victory, and the Lord will wipe away tears from off all faces, and the rebuke of his people shall he take away from off all the earth, for the Lord hath spoken it. So, once again, folks, we pose the questions, right? Because these are the questions that we have to ask. Not just what is God saying, but does he mean this specifically, literally? Or is he speaking to us figuratively? And again, we're not opposed to that, folks. God does speak to us about some things figuratively. God is a master of language. He knows how to use metaphor. He knows how to use simile. If you are really inclined to go this way, right? If grammar and those kinds of things really rocked your world, and a Baptist preacher from a long, long time ago, Benjamin Keach, wrote a book called Preaching from the Types and Metaphors of the Bible. And if you lay it down on its back, it's about 4 inches thick. And he just goes through all the figures of speech and the way the Lord uses them in the Scriptures. And that's not the issue. That's not the problem. That's not what we're asking. We're asking, is he really going to do these things to real nations? And if not, is he talking to me figuratively? What is he saying to me figuratively? What is the message that is being conveyed? Isaiah chapter 26 and verse number 1. And again, I'm just highlighting selected verses here. In that day shall this song be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks. Chapter 7, verse number 1. In that day the Lord with his sore and great and strong sword shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, that crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea. Down to verse number 12. And it shall come to pass in that day. And by the way, the emphasis, right? Do you notice the common denominator to the passages? In that day. In that day. In that day. Isaiah always speaks about these things in light of there being a coming day. In that day. There's a day coming, says Isaiah. And when that day comes, this is going to happen. There's a day coming. And when that day comes, this is going to happen. There's a day coming. And when that day comes, these are the things that are going to happen. That's the pattern of speech that Isaiah has. So he tends to be, my understanding, speaking rather specifically, anticipating a particular day, a day. And we will eventually get to this for talk, because the Lord talks about a day. He talks about it being his day. And not like Sunday is the Lord's day, which it is, but the Lord is going to have his day. And when the Lord has his day, these are the things that we should be expecting. Verse number 12, it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall beat off from the channel of the river unto the stream of Egypt, and ye shall be gathered one by one, O ye children of Israel. And it shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come which were ready to perish in the land of Assyria, and the outcasts in the land of Egypt, and shall worship the Lord in the holy mount at Jerusalem. In that day. In that day. Isaiah chapter 34. Isaiah 34, verse number 1. Come near, ye nations, to hear. Hearken, ye people. Let the earth hear, and all that is therein, the world and all things that come forth of it. For the indignation of the Lord is upon all nations, and his fury upon all their armies. He hath utterly destroyed them. He hath delivered them to the slaughter. And then Isaiah chapter 35. Right? So you have the Lord's judgment upon the nations and all of them delivered to the slaughter. Isaiah 35, 1, the wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them. The desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly. Rejoice even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given unto it. The excellency of Carmel and Sharon, they shall see the glory of the Lord and the excellency of our God. Strengthen ye the weak hands, confirm the feeble knees. Say unto them that are of a fearful heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, even God with a recompense. He will come and save you. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap as an hart, and the tongue of the dumb sing. For in the wilderness the water shall waters break out, and streams in the desert, and parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water, and the habitation of dragons, where each lay shall be grass with reeds and rushes. And an highway shall be there, and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for those, the wayfaring men, though fools, shall not err therein. No lion shall be there, nor any ravenous beast shall go up thereon. It shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. Now again, folks, look, to some extent, we in fundamentalism, when it comes to these kinds of things, tend to be, I don't want to say our own worst enemies, but we don't do ourselves any favor. Right? We read the desert will blossom like a rose, and then we point out the effects of irrigation upon the land of Israel, which are marvelous. And the way a country that really is a desert manages to feed itself, and it is amazing, but it is not what is being described here, folks. I mean, I can't say to you, I am a Bible literalist. I believe Isaiah chapter 35, and here's the proof. Israel irrigates its crops. That doesn't scratch the surface of what's predicted in Isaiah 35. That's just not a dent in what's predicted in Isaiah 35. That Israel has, and they do, they have, you know, they told us, you know, and they know we're Americans, you know, and we were over there, and they said, you know, you guys, when you irrigate, you turn on the hose and you spray water everywhere. We don't have enough water to spray water everywhere. We drip water on every individual plant in Israel. And that's just not the way people garden in their front yard. That's the way farmers garden. They drip water on every individual plant. That is not Isaiah 35, folks. That is just not Isaiah 35. Isaiah 41. All right, so Isaiah, right, in the course, and Isaiah, like everybody else, is living in a particular time, and he is watching his own local news, so to speak, and he is aware of the growing threat of the Assyrians, and he is aware of his own country's political intrigues with other localized smaller nations trying to build a coalition and an alliance to deal with the growing Assyrian threat. And God inspires him to write. And in writing about that, he looks well beyond his day, well out into future days. So he talks about the king, and he talks about the kingdom and the characteristics of the kingdom and the nature of the king. And Isaiah also devotes a tremendous amount of time to what he calls God's servant. Look at verse number 8 of Isaiah chapter 41. But thou, Israel, art my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend. Thou whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called thee from the chief men thereof and said unto thee, Thou art my servant, I have chosen thee and not cast thee away. Fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. I will strengthen thee, yea, I will help thee. Yea, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness. So there is the servant, and the servant is identified. Thou, Israel, art my servant. And then look, if you would, at Isaiah chapter 42. All right, so in Isaiah chapter 41, we have the servant identified as who? The nation. And then we have Isaiah 42:1. Behold, my servant whom I uphold, mine elect in whom my soul delighteth. I have put my spirit upon him. He shall bring forth judgment to the Gentiles. He shall not cry, nor lift up, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed shall he not break, and the smoking flax shall he not quench. He shall bring forth judgment unto truth. He shall not fail nor be discouraged till he have set judgment in the earth, and the isles shall wait for his law. So here's the servant. Here is the discussion about the servant. Look at, if you would, at Isaiah 49. And we're going to return to this. Actually, Isaiah 49 was where this morning's lesson was scheduled to begin. Isaiah 49, Listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, ye people from far. The Lord hath called me from the womb. From the bowels of my mother hath he made mention of my name, and he hath made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of his hand hath he hid me, and made me a polished chaff. In his quiver hath he hid me. And said unto me, Thou art my servant, O Israel, in whom I will be glorified. Then I said, I have labored in vain. I have spent my strength for naught and in vain. Yet surely my judgment is with the Lord, and my work with my God. And now saith the Lord that formed me from the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob again to him. Though Israel be not gathered, yet shall I be glorious in the eyes of the Lord. And my God shall be my strength. Now again, we're going to return to this. In Isaiah 52 and 53, the subject is the servant. The subject is the servant. Right? So who is the servant? Who is the servant? Is the servant the entire nation of Israel? Or is the servant an individual. Or is it possible that there are two servants that are being identified there? Turn ahead, if you would, to Matthew chapter 12, and I'm going to just start to kind of wind this down here. Matthew chapter 12, verse number 15. But when Jesus knew it, he withdrew himself from thence, and great multitudes followed him, and he healed them. He healed them all, and charged them that they should not make him known, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, Behold, my servant, whom I have chosen, my beloved, in whom my soul is well pleased. I will put my spirit upon him, and he shall show judgment to the Gentiles. He shall not strive nor cry, neither shall any man hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed shall he not break, and smoking flax shall he not quench, till he send forth judgment unto victory, and in his name shall the Gentiles trust. This is a quotation, folks, from the prediction of Isaiah 42, 1 through 4. So in Isaiah 41, we have this kind of national identity to the servant, but in every other instance, the servant is spoken of in individual terms. Oh, how am I going to do here on my time? I'm gonna stop here. I'm looking at the clock. And we'll resume this. I don't want to gloss over this, and I don't want to be laborious, so we'll come back to this. All right, so it's 12 minutes to 11. Thank you very much. We'll be back in 12 minutes.